They've asked us to introduce ourselves. I'm Doris Edmond. I'm from Thousand Oaks, California. I teach some courses from time to time at California Lutheran College in early childhood education. I also work considerably in the Christian education field, more or less as a workshopper, consultant, and that sort of thing. I also write for Creative Teaching Press. That is idea materials for early childhood. The subject today is morality. Can it be taught? I hope that as I give my presentation, you will think of ideas that come to your mind, questions, illustrations, that might enhance our discussion after I finish. Morality, can it be taught? There's a real distinction between internal moral development and outward social adjustment. Adjustment to the group is no substitute for moral maturity. What is moral maturity? Can we define it? Can we teach it? Can we exemplify it? Out of a deep concern for children and with a real confusion about our own role as teacher and parent, we need to study this problem. In research and various studies dealing with moral character and moral feeling, there seems to be a positive correlation between measures of honesty and measures of persistence and self-control, a finding which to some extent supports a notion of just good general character. In research, findings which have yielded substantial correlations between moral conduct and general intelligence, the tendency to anticipate future events, the capacity to maintain focused attention and to control aggressive fantasies, and self-esteem. Now, these variables are all aspects of strength of ego. This is the conscious decision maker, rather than superego, which is the conscience. Ego variables grow and develop with age, whereas conscience factors are assumed by theorists to be established in the first 6 to 10 years of life. Accordingly, if the interpretation of moral character as ego strength is correct, there should be improvement with age. The Watergate affair has us all mystified. After watching the defendants on TV, I'm sure you were convinced, as I was, that these men show above average, these men are above average in social adjustment. They certainly demonstrated a pervasive subservience to authority. One after another, they claimed the authority of those above them. Their principal defense was that they were merely following orders. Such defense was decisively demolished in their trials, and individual responsibility was raised to a high principle, as it had been by America's own founding fathers. They, in the Declaration of Independence, rejected government by royal fiat. Now, a mere 200 years later, we find significant executive illegality being justified in the name of authority. They seem to assume that legality has no status independent of personal authority, that it depends on that authority. This was a view that pervaded the Watergate plot. It is what the politicizing of justice means. Morality in this view is infinitely bendable, being tied strongly to personal expediency. Anything goes. Those at the heart of the shameful conspiracy have felt surrounded by danger. They have wrapped the concept of national security around their personal sense of emergency and used it to justify any act. Forgery, burglary, spying, lying. What implications are there then as to our responsibilities in raising the coming generation? There are a wide range of studies relating different disciplinary and child-rearing techniques to self-judgment. The results are ambiguous. All over, the findings suggest that the formation of strong guilt tendencies may not be a universal part of childhood development, and that moral conduct may be regulated more by ego strength, judgment, and situational expectations. Clear enough is the fact that neither homilies nor harsh discipline produce ethical behavior. The most powerful and suggestive work done recently on moral development is Kohlberg's. His name is spelled K-O-H-L-B-E-R-G. I wonder how many of you are familiar with that name. Kohlberg is really considered now the leading authority on as far as moral development is concerned. He has done the most significant research. He's written in the journals and has published some very significant things on moral development. His is based on a generally Piagetian framework. Kohlberg conceptualized six levels of moral judgment associated with specific age trends. They range from simple punishment avoidance orientation through conformity to established authorities to morality based on individual conscience. As Kohlberg traces each state, two trends are notable. One is the increasing focus on abstract principle as a basis for morality, away from expediency and conformity. The other is toward widening acceptance of all individuals as worthy of right judgment, regardless of closeness to self or friendship. Just because somebody did me a favor, I'll do him a favor. If that's the way we operate, then we find there's probably something lacking in our moral judgment. If we prefer to heap favors on someone we know rather than someone we don't know who may be in the same position. As one studies the testimony of the Watergate witnesses, one is struck by the low level of moral thinking evidenced in terms of these particular trends. Again and again, action is justified by pragmatic reciprocity, intentionality, and respect for authority. Abstract principle seems unheard of. Supreme authority is never mentioned. Our responsibility, then, for the moral development of our children depends, first of all, on an understanding of maturity in this sphere. With Kohlberg as a guide, we may define moral maturity as behavior and feeling based on abstract principle in relation to people who are not close to us. That is, they are removed from our own identification. His studies have suggested that those children involved in more extensive and varied social participation or responsibilities were, on the whole, more mature in moral judgment. This contradicts older notions that the basic values transmitted by the family, the peer group, and the wider society tend to be in conflict, that rather, and this is quoting Kohlberg again, the child lies in a total social world in which perceptions of the law, of the peer group, and of parental teachings all influence one another. While various people and groups make conflicting demands upon the child, they do not seem to present the child with basically conflicting or difficult general moral values. In the course of normal development, the conflict between demands of groups and individuals constitute the material for the discrimination and development of such general moral values. And that's the end of Kohlberg's quotation. The implications are clear, if troubling. Neither punishment, nor permissiveness, nor preaching leads to sound moral development. Only one path remains, that of exemplification. But it is not enough to practice honesty and fairness in one's own family or neighborhood or classroom. The world must be one's family. The world of people who do not think like us, who do not look like us, who have different cultures, different values, a different way of living. How can we, as teachers and parents of young children, help lay this foundation of acceptance of differences? It seems that we in the field of Christian education have the greatest way in the world to help children understand, because they learn from the very beginning that God created us all people are precious in the sight of God, and we indeed are fortunate if we have many different kinds of children in our school and church school. Ideally, each class would be made up of the widest variety of children possible. Ideally, our church and school and church would be in an integrated community where people of different colors, backgrounds, languages could be called upon, for instance, to visit our school. A person from India might come with to our school with in costume, teach the children a few Hindi words, polite phrases, maybe some games, and when I was in Calcutta, I thought, I bet these children really have some interesting games they play that I can learn about and take back home. So I asked little Fazio, the son of one of our friends, what his favorite game was, and he said, Cowboys and Indians. I didn't learn a thing. If any of your teacher's aides know a foreign language, the children will enjoy learning some of the polite phrases in that language, at least hello and goodbye and excuse me and that sort of thing. The children will enjoy learning the names of objects. If you make a game of it by placing these objects in the center of the room, and as the name of the object is called in the foreign country, called in the foreign language. They may take turns in going up and getting these objects that the person names. Little Todd was going to have to move to Madrid because his father was transferred, and one of his mother's friends asked him, he said, Todd, can you speak Spanish? Well, we had been having an assistant who had taught the children these French phrases, and so Todd felt, well, he could really speak French. He said, no, I don't speak Spanish, but I do speak French. The children should learn that to be different is good and desirable. If they see how variety makes for a more interesting and exciting world, they won't have such a tendency to be ashamed if they are different, or to tease the other child who is different. We have a little song that I teach my children, or did teach my children when I worked with small children, called Differences Are Fun. What if all flowers were small and blue? What if the birds sang the same song too? What if your friends looked just like you? What a dull world this would be. I'm glad the flowers are different each one. I'm glad that the birds sing their own little song. If we don't look alike, we know that's not wrong. It's fun to be different, you see. And then we follow that little song with a game, pointing out how we differ from our friend, that maybe his eyes are blue and mine are green, or mine are brown. How maybe our skin is a different color. We're wearing different clothes, but that's good. I think there's just been too much emphasis on conformity, so that the children who are a little different, maybe a little retarded or handicapped, maybe a little bit spastic, are sort of segregated from the other children, rather than saying, well, here is an opportunity to help that child, to be of assistance. It's good to have him in our room. Breckenridge and E. L. Vincent list the widening of social horizons as one of the basic needs of children for strong moral growth. Along with this, they emphasize the importance, and this is interesting to me, of good physical health. Healthy kids are more likely to have courage to stand on their own two feet and to resist temptation. They are more likely to be free of bitterness and desire for revenge that get kids into trouble. Another thing needed for moral growth, of course, is emotional security. Children who are loved and wanted don't feel isolated and bitter against society. Children who know, first of all, that God loves them even when they're naughty, and that their parents, too, love them unconditionally. Busy children, too, who are helped to express their feelings of adventure and excitement in wholesome ways, are not driven to be bad because of boredom. Self-control, of course, comes high on the list of basic things children need for strong moral growth. The child who knows how to pray and ask God's help will gain inner strength not known to the child who has not been taught about God's help. As the child builds self-control, the child becomes able to discipline his impulses. He finds that immediate gratification is not always the most satisfying reward. Sometimes some things are worth waiting for. And then, of course, the child needs the inspiration to desire what's right. If this is strong enough, he will find sincere satisfaction in doing right. Children need models. Older siblings, as well as parents, are their first models. Later on, when they extend themselves into the neighborhood and community, they find people who they admire and emulate. Here again, we who teach in a Christian context have a real advantage. After all, we believe that God sent his Son so that he might show us how to live the exemplary life and be an inspiration for us all to live a life of love and of service. The stories of Jesus as he lived and moved here on earth as a human being give the child a concrete example of the kind of life worth emulating. Character, according to the Union College research definition, must include purposiveness, a real life goal toward which the individual is striving. For a child to develop his potential, he needs to acquire a social vision, a dominating purpose in the service of mankind. From the study of maturity in children, the evidence indicates that maturity contains two strong dimensions, idealism and realism. A child who is over-idealistic gains maturity as he adds realism to his life. A realistic child grows toward maturity when he adds idealism. The uniqueness of the child plays a vital role. It is important to help him find his own important contribution to the world. This is the essence of positive mental health. An attitude which this research indicates is best started at the nursery level, and that's a desire to be happy, so that you can infect others with your happiness. Feeling good about oneself, of course, is basic to anyone's happiness. How many adults do you know, do you meet each day who infect you with their happiness? In selecting a teacher for my child, I would first want to find a person who is happy with himself or herself. Only then could I expect to find the child eager to go to school and eager to participate fully in the program planned. Because if the teacher is happy, she's going to have a happy classroom. And there, I might add too, that teachers who are easily bored are usually the best teachers, because they don't want to be bored. They would never think of teaching this class this year the same way they taught their class last year. That would be boring to them. In the first place, they have different children. In the second place, they're different people this year than they were last year. So a person who is easily bored, looking for exciting things to do and interesting things to taste and participate in, they're apt to give that same enthusiasm and eagerness to the children in their classroom. Nursery school children, teachers, I spent one summer just, Rudy and I traveled around the world, just, and I, he looked at the rocks, went to the seashore and gathered the sand and that sort of thing, but he also went with me to and enjoyed my my thing, which was visiting nursery schools. And you know, I didn't find an unhappy nursery school teacher in the whole lot. And I can see why, because here they work with little children who, in my estimation, are perhaps at the most delightful age level that they'll ever be in their life. They're eager to please, they're anxious to learn, they're full of curiosity and expectation, and they're full of love and admiration. If we could only find a magic formula that could reinforce and preserve those delightful traits for a lifetime, they would be on, you know, they would be giving everyone they meet a high, you might say. Children that age are affectionate to the point where it's almost embarrassing sometimes for the teachers to come and kiss your hand and tell you how much they love you, and they're so open with their affection. As we help children grow in character, we can't help but grow ourselves. The foundation for a child's growing attitude that he is part of the universe are laid very early when he realized that the universe is basically friendly. Man has been given the freedom of choice to use the forces of the universe for good or for evil. Research has shown that even a nursery child begins to learn that when he is a co-worker with God, helping to release the power of good in the world, the universe is friendly. When he makes wrong choices through ignorance or willfulness, releasing the power of destruction and harm, then his universe becomes unfriendly in more ways than one. It is our job as teachers and parents to help the child find joy in cooperating with the adults around him who are trying to help him. He needs praise and positive reinforcement when he is cooperative. And we should talk with him about the times when he has made other people happy by his cooperation. That's a good topic for a discussion at mealtime, not reiterating all the wrongs that have been done during the day, but rather the times you've been made to feel good because you saw your child doing something that showed real positive growth in character, personality, and general strength of character. We need to make sure that non-cooperation never achieves any desirable results not even the excitement of disapproval. There are times when something should be ignored, but then there are times when firmness on important issues is a better course of action. There may be a situation when a child needs time to express negative feelings before we can expect him to cooperate. Blind adherence to authority is not what we are after. There are times when a child should see the natural outcome of his behavior as long as the outcome is not too drastic. We need to show our children that we enjoy cooperating with them when they make requests or have suggestions. And children usually cooperate more cheerfully if they have some choices. Just make sure that each choice would be okay. Do you want to wear this sweater or your jacket when you go out to play today? Expecting cooperation is absolutely necessary if we expect him to do it. This raises the quality of interaction between the child and adult, which is a powerful motivating factor. Just the way we make a request to a child, instead of put on your sweater, or it's much easier, it's cold out there, haven't you been out, see how cold it is, instead of that kind of a request or demand, just say, I think it's a little chilly out, you might need a wrap, would you like to wear your sweater or your jacket? There's so many different ways of asking a child in order to get him in the mood of cooperating with the authority, whoever it happens to be. When we expect him to do it and say it in a way that we expect him to do it, he's much more apt to do it. He also cooperates more happily when his personal plans are taken into consideration. Often he needs a few minutes to finish what he's doing. We can't expect him to come to supper now when he's just getting something balanced with his blocks. We need to tell him ahead of time, in 10 minutes we're going to have supper, so start finishing up what you're doing. It's only reasonable that we should give him a little warning. And he needs to know that we have definite reasons for the things we request him to do. Eric Erickson tells us, and Eric Erickson is the big name in social development these days, just as Piaget is the big name in conceptual development and Kohlberg's a big name in moral development. Eric Erickson tells us if our goal is to promote a child's mental health, we must help him develop faith and trust. As faith and trust is relayed from person to person, the feeling of security will be promoted, ego strength will grow, and the child's capacity to meet and constructively adjust to the multiple demands placed upon him will be maintained most efficiently. The most valued component for promoting security and ego growth, of course, is love. God's love, family's love, and ultimately the love of those outside of the family. I believe that the basis for morality is the love of God. Each child needs a clear idea of what is right and what is wrong, and an interest in doing acceptable things. A child needs the assurance that adults will carry part of the responsibility for his behavior. Given freedom beyond his capacity to govern himself, he can become very frightened. An environment that defines wise limits promotes real freedom. As a child develops the capacity to handle his own impulses, he is given more and more freedom, and greater demands are then placed upon him by those around him. A child needs consistent limits as he struggles to find a pattern for certain fundamental urges. As he finds gratifying channels of expression for his impulses, he becomes psychologically healthier, freer of anxiety, and more emotional energy. We are interested in the origins of the positive, altruistic behaviors of our children, since they appear to be progenitors of such behaviors in adults. Adult prosocial behavior is critically important for society as well as for the well-being of the prosocial adult himself. The altruistic capacity to give much more than they apparently receive, as parents do for their children, teachers do for students, pastors do for the members of their congregation, forms one of the bases of socialization, education, patriotism, love, social order, and cooperative cohesion. It is believed that these capacities spring from childhood antecedents. It behooves us who work with young children to emphasize the positive side of each child's nature, give him positive reinforcement when he displays commendable character traits, and help him to feel good about himself. It behooves us who work with young children to emphasize the positive side of each child's nature, give him positive reinforcement when he displays commendable character traits, and help him to feel good about himself. And of course, one of the people I spoke with last week said, what about the kid who thinks he's so great, you know, he becomes very obnoxious. Well, really, the person who really feels great about himself does not become obnoxious. It's the child who doesn't feel so great about himself, who feels he's got to have everybody's attention, and who puts on this big facade about being great, that is the obnoxious child. I think we have to, too, help the child realize that if he's good at something, sure, he recognizes this fact. He is good. But it also behooves himself to help the child who isn't so good, who doesn't have the same talent he has. In school, if he comes home and says, I got all the words right, but Charlie, who sat next to me, missed five, I think a parent's reaction should be, sure, I'm glad you got them all right. Now maybe you could help Charlie tomorrow so he can get them all right too. Helping them feel a responsibility to lift the other one up, not this competitive feeling of I want to be better than everybody, but rather I want to do my best. I want to fulfill my potential. So there is a positive correlation, as I'm just going to sum up the presentation briefly here. There is a positive correlation between honesty and measures of persistence and self-control. There's a positive correlation between honesty, moral maturity and general intelligence, and the tendency to anticipate future events, the capacity to maintain focused attention, the control of aggressive fantasies, self-esteem, there's usually a positive correlation between morality and self-esteem. The person who is not morally honest is not going to have much self-respect. There's going to be a very inner feeling of discomfort with their own selves because they know they have done wrong. There is a positive correlation between honesty and the abstract principle as a basis of morality. A widening acceptance of all individuals who are worthy of right treatment, regardless of closeness to self or friendship. This is a sign of moral maturity. And respect for God. That's the real basis. The love and respect of God is the basis for all moral maturity. And we find that neither punishment nor permissiveness nor preaching is effective in helping a child grow morally. But exemplification is. Good health is. Emotional security is. A busy children are usually less apt to go astray. Self-control should be encouraged in our children. Idealism and realism should be balanced out, and as Jim probably would say, orchestrated. Purposiveness. A growing attitude that he is part of the universe, and the universe is basically friendly. There needs to be a substantial feeling of faith and trust. There needs to be freedom within his capacity to govern. In other words, we as parents and teachers, adults around our children, need to set wise limits. There need to be gratifying channels of expressions for his impulses, so that he becomes freer of anxieties with more emotional energy. Some of the negative things are subservience or authority, personal expediency, anything goes, just do it. A personal sense of emergency, homilies and harsh discipline. These are negative things. Conformity to the group. And of course this is a group who have negative purposes. But if the child feels good about himself and he trusts his own judgment, then he's more apt to carry out what he basically feels is right. And he doesn't have to depend on the gang to give him approval and make him feel good about himself. He feels confident on his own that he's capable of a wise judgment, and he doesn't need to go along with the gang. Now, what's been going through your minds, and do you have comments that you would like to make? Questions that maybe somebody can answer? Yes?
I teach preschool handicapped, and what you're saying, I don't really support about the attitude of the teacher and the teacher himself. Good attitude about children and generally good attitude about life. I was wondering, I'm concerned about maybe some teachers that aren't that enthused, or maybe, have lost enthusiasm over the years. And if some of the colleges can do some screening or something, giving suggestions or something, so that we're sure that the teachers that come out today and are ready to teach, are well qualified aesthetically,
Right.
Academically,
Yeah.
A lot of them are, but I think, aesthetically, I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, they, I know at California Lutheran College, this is the principle here. They want to screen out those who are emotionally and personality-wise not suitable to be with young children. And they're just, that's why I think it's important that we get to know right away what the student wants to do. Let him do some student teaching early in his college career so that we can screen out early enough so that he doesn't finish his 4 years of college and then we find out, well, he's not suitable to teach. That's a very good point. And I think one reason why Christian colleges have less problem in placing their graduates in teaching positions is that superintendents all over the world, or all over the country, all over the United States, have found out that these are basically good, emotionally developed, morally mature people. And they've used them before and they want more of them. I know that it was one of the things that's happening at California Lutheran College. Superintendents say, you know, got any more like that? We want them. And the same thing was happening at Augustana College in Rock Island when we taught there. Chances are kids who come to a Christian college have been reared in a Christian home. And they may stray. They may not be, you know, the perfect kids in college. They may cut up a bit. But that background is there. And that's going to come to the fore when they get out on their own and have a responsible job. They know what's right. They know what's wrong. Yes. Excuse me.
This is you brought up a point about the happy teacher does a pretty good job teaching no matter what the other thinks. And this bothers me now that teaching is... I'll say the word generally here, I won't say universally, but they're leaning towards unionization. And nobody gets fired, you've got a place, you've got seniority, you've got all this. And this bothers me because...
doesn't bother us.
if you're really of depth of 30, that doesn't mean that time you're going to change, you're going to be all right at 60.
Right, right. I know my husband was academic dean for a number of years, and he was saddled with this problem. Teachers who had really were just there hanging on, you know, and what are you going to do? They have tenure. Then students aren't registering for their classes because they're not good teachers. And it's devastating, really. And they're doing everything they can to get rid of that tenure program. In fact, we tenured only one teacher this year in the whole faculty. So they're not tenuring like they used to.
I wish this were true in public schools.
Well, I think that they probably are trying to do this too. But the problem with the public schools is usually they have a set rule. After you've been there 3 years and you've been hired 3 years in a row, then you are automatically tenured. What they are beginning to do now is to watch those 2 years very carefully and then firing them after the end of the second year so that they do not teach the third year and become automatically tenured. They're learning a lot of things now about this because they're suffering, because many places the enrollment has dropped in the schools with birth control and all. Our schools are not as filled as they in many places as they used to be, and they just don't need as many teachers.
Doris, you mentioned, you know, we can't teach, and I don't know why I say I'm not a teacher, but you can't teach morality. And it's through example, right? Is this kind of the general, as I perceive it anyway?
Yes.
Why, don't we then really have a problem? Or is the example of the school teacher and the example of the Sunday school teacher, is that adequate I personally don't think it is, and don't we really have a problem? The example has to come from the home.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So we aren't solving, you know, this isn't really, we're not answering a question or solving a problem for the kids that don't get these examples from home, because everything that you said would be good for helping this child attain a good moral is exactly opposite of what so many of these kids get in their home. And I personally feel, I teach Sunday school, and there's no way that 1 hour a Sunday are you going to help the moral character of some of these kids.
I know. I taught a summer course in Chicago, or River Forest at Concordia this summer, and I was talking about the fact that in early childhood, usually the child is eager to please, and you know, we can get him to come along with us, and we don't have the severe discipline problems, and they all seem to want to do the right thing, and I really got a guffawed on that. One of the girls who teaches in a Lutheran church school, daytime school, said, "That's wrong, Mrs. Edmonds. I teach right in the middle of Chicago or Southside or wherever it was." And she said, just as an example, all of a sudden one day we noticed all pencils had disappeared. The next day, all erasers. Pretty soon the other things kept disappearing. And finally she said, "All right, come on now. I want to find out where this stuff is." And one boy held up his hand. He said, "I engineered the whole thing." He said, "I've got my mop." And they all had their specific time when they were supposed to swipe all the pencils and the specific time when they were going to get the erasers. And in his locker, there was a stash, everything stashed away in his locker. Well, she thought, "Gee, I've got to tell his mother. She'll just be heartbroken." And his mother said, "He is the brightest child." Now, what are you going to do? Talk about teaching parents. I mean, teaching children, we've got to teach parents. That's why I feel that every Sunday school teacher's job is not only to be concerned about that one child she has in her Sunday school class, but if she's going to do a 100% job, she's got to know that family. She has to know where that child comes from and how she can help those parents in that home.
And also some statistics say that child's personality, a greater percentage of the child's personality is developed between ages of 2 and 4, which means, you know, there's a real basis there that starts out in the home. And I think, you know, I really am thinking for parent education. You know, where is it going to be done? No, I thought about, okay, high school. A lot of kids aren't interested in high school. They could care less. You know, maybe they're not ready for that kind of thing. They don't really realize what's going on. And then college, you know, well, not everybody goes to college. So I don't know how, you know, what kinds of just general discussion groups parents bring their problems, frustrations, you know, likes, dislikes about raising children. Because no training is done in that, and that's the most important, you know, job.
Right. Now, most nursery schools have meetings with the parents, and if it's a good preschool or nursery school or whatever, they will have parent study groups where the parents are. They try to reach the parents with some real helps so that they can undergird their child at home in the same way that they're helping them to go in school.
How do you get the men to participate in?
Well, you'd be amazed. I spoke to the parents' group of the lab school at CLC, and I think there were as many men as women, and in fact, there are quite often more men than women because they don't take the child each morning, and mothers can check in on what's going on. They may have a bulletin board saying, "We're doing this today," while the fathers don't have that. So when it comes to a parent meeting and either one of the parents have to stay home to take care of the baby, quite often it's the father who comes and the mother who stays home. And more fathers are taking the responsibility that they should have taken a long time ago with their children. They're realizing it's their job too. Now, this isn't true all over, I'm sure, and I'm sure there are many places where it's the opposite true. But it isn't that way universally, where fathers are not interested.
We used to plan in our meetings little things for fathers to do, you know, like have little repair things or toys or whatever, you know, mention that, you know, that would be done at that meeting. So parents, you know, fathers who need it, you know, for repair or whatever.
And some, some nursery schools will have a session and conduct it just like they do during the day, but invite the fathers to come and participate in the program. It might be a Saturday morning, might be an evening, early evening. Yes?
How much influence has this TV got on these youngsters that see to spend more hours in front of it sometimes than they do?
More than we would like, and I think we have a real responsibility here to censor the programs we don't want our children to see, and before we can do that, we've got to watch them ourselves. And we owe a responsibility to the whole populace of the United States to write to the people who produce undesirable films, undesirable programs, undesirable commercials. Write to the people who are manufacturing that product and say, as long as you keep that commercial on, I'm not going to buy your product. It's a detriment. And we have to become more vocal. They do listen to single individuals who write articulate letters. Do it. It's worth the time and the 10-cent stamp.
It's the sponsors that sponsor the program. So if you write the commercial to the sponsor and say, hey, I don't like that program you're sponsoring, they won't sponsor it anymore.
That's right.
The program won't get any support.
That's what I'm talking about. Go to, it's the people that are paying for the program that you need to write to. And really, the single citizen can have a real impact. And this is what parent groups ought to do. Talk about these things at parent meetings and organize to make an impact against the things that are negative influences on our children. Come in to invade our home.
I was asked one time, where do they write? And I couldn't tell them. If you were going to write to
a... You write to the... just address it to the station. Put president of Quaker Oats, you know, or whatever it happens to be. President of Quaker Oats Company. And then that's the only thing I know how to do, unless you can get the product and look on the box and see where it's manufactured. You can do that.
Well, buy the product.
Don't buy the product, just look at the address in the store. Yeah, right.
I read someplace that they keep track of these letters, and the stations, the TV stations or whatever, put them in a file, and then about every 6 months to a year, some group, a committee, whatever, goes around, and they can pull out their file.
Yeah, it wouldn't hurt to make a duplicate letter,
yeah.
You know, one to the station and one to the manufacturer. Now, I think TV does have a really, it has a lot of good positive influences. I think the little David and Goliath puppet thing is just fabulous for children. And some stations carry this regularly, usually Sunday mornings.
I have a concern with the TV, but I also have a concern with the number of children who are in each bracket, but they're not preschool, nursery material, they're not even grade 1 to 4 anymore. Mothers working, dads working, and they are on the loose from, say, after school until 6 or 3, and maybe again after 7, because,
well, I know more and more churches are becoming concerned about after-school care, and they are setting up after-school care facilities in their churches with a good positive program going on, where the child is comes every day until a certain time when they expect the parents home for supper at least.
I know I'm saying that as a mother that has been home up now, my children are, I'm home, but their girl is home.
To
these other places where mother isn't home. That's right.
And
where do I get him? You know, I want him to come to my home. I don't want to watch over them. Please, but I'd like to know where you are. Yeah. And I'd like to bring this in. But there are these places, even in age 12 to 14, like 10 to 14, where kids are sort of all experimenting with a lot of things.
I know.
And these are the parents that are not supposed to engage them in the program to get them there saying, well, you know, they're exposing themselves.
Right.
And they'd rather put a key around your child's neck and have them touch it and let them have freedom.
Yeah, that's very sad.
Isn't this kind of a scary thing of the whole thing? We're talking here now, you know, about the schools doing this and the churches are doing this. This is what scares me to death. And I'm afraid we're going to wind up some point down the road with just a bunch of robots. Because the parents, the family, the home is being voided. And not, you know, and there's certainly need for a lot of stuff, but I really wish that millions of dollars would be devoted to helping people become parents.
I do. That's a good thought.
Rather than worrying about the children, you know, they got to be taken care of. But I'm just scared that we're going to have, you know, there's not going to be the home. Like you mentioned this morning, you know, maternal instinct is not natural. And in some areas, talking about the two, the three, the four-year-old, we're talking about public education now, taking these kids out of the home, you know. And that to me is terribly scary.
It's close to ponder. The problem is, the problem is there.
That's, yeah.
So we can't ignore it.
That's right.
We can't let these kids run free. But so if we can have a program where some place where they can come, these kids who, we're not going to change their home.
No, that's right. But are we also, you know, kind of sticking our head in the sand and ignoring the basic problem? This is, I don't know if it can be resolved or not, but I'm just pointing that this is something that scares me, that, you know, if we could just take these dollars and help people become parents instead of, you know, while we're solving the problem.
Well, there is a program for training parents. I know we have one in Simi, the next town over from us, an adult education class. The government is sponsoring it, where they the parent must come one night a week for class, learning about children and how to take care of their children and how to teach their children. And they're called cooperative nursery schools. The government also hires a director who is responsible for teaching these parents. And then the parents take turns in helping, cooperating in teaching the nursery school. I think parents who are brought into the school situation, even adults who volunteer, learn an awful lot about child psychology and how best to handle the children if they can come right into the schoolroom situation and watch someone who knows a function and operate. They get a pattern so that they're like one mother who came to visit, she says, "Don't you ever whop?" You know, and she just figured if they did something they did wrong, the automatic thing was to give them a whop.
Hello, Dad. In Illinois now, well, they just have to mandatory where you have to buy education for 3 to 6 year olds that are handicapped. And they're adding a 0 to 3 program for children that are handicapped, you know, which may be against your, however, I feel this is great because the 0 to 3 program is a homebound program for the teacher and maybe a social worker, whatever, goes into the home and helps the parents.
Yeah, you're really working with the parents and not the child.
Yeah, I think as long as the programs keep the parents in touch, you know, I think that's a great way to train the parents rather than having, okay, not knowing the children, just having some social worker or something go and talk to a group of parents. But they can't really relate to the individual child, whereas if you have a child in the program, you know the child's problem, you know the way the home operates, and so you mm-hmm. can, you know, coincide and maybe get more helpful suggestions.
Well, I do know that at California Lutheran College, where I teach, that in order to get an early childhood credential, you have to take a course in parent education. And this is emphasized all the way through, that this is what you do for the parents, and this is the way you involve the parents. The parents are one of our chief concerns in early childhood education, is becoming more and more this way. That's just a hopeful sign. Thank you very much.